This morning I want to talk about three things: when to save, how to save, and how much to save. When to save should start early in life. Saving is actually a lifelong endeavor, which I'll talk about here in a little bit, but saving should begin early. And if you're not saving by 3 years old, you're off to a bad start. So, Braden, you should already be a seasoned investor at this point. You are 11. You've had at least 8 years. But if you're not there yet, you still have time. But 60 years will pass by quicker than you think, so you need to get busy right now. But parents should teach their children to start saving money and tithing as well from the youngest of ages, as soon as they acquire money from gifts or from working, doing tasks around the house for which they are paid. That's a great way to get children off on the right foot, teaching them to be financially responsible with money from the time they're just wee little. Even, like I said, I'm not even joking, at 3 years old, when you get your first $10 gift for your birthday when you're 3 years old, teach them to put half of it in the, you have your save, get your give, save, and spend categories, little piggy bank envelopes, whatever. Put half in your save, put 10% in your giving to the Lord, and then spend the other 40. And they probably won't even understand at that point how to divide it up, but you help them divide it up. And especially when they can see it in coins, especially coins, bills. To a kid, a bill is a bill. It doesn't matter. Just a short story. One time, I learned my lesson. But when it was for my niece's birthday, and I was apparently feeling generous, and so I gave her $20 for her birthday, but I gave her a $20 bill. And she was just wee little, and she opens up the card and pulls out the 20 and says, "Huh, I got a dollar." And I thought, well, that was stupid. I could have given her a dollar, and she'd have been just as happy. So I learned my lesson. If you're going to do that, give them 20 $1 bills, and they will think they're rich, that you're the best uncle or grandparent or parent or whatever in the world. So I tried that with some church kids up in Minneapolis. And the funny thing was, they got all these really nice gifts from their grandparents and all. I mean, spending way, way too much money on a birthday. And you know what gift they were the most excited about? The $21 bills from me. Far more excited about that than anything else. So anyway, there's a little lesson for you if you want to impress people with very little money. But that's really important, though, to teach your kids to start saving at a very young age. And I think I mentioned this before, but don't give your kids an allowance. Okay, if you give your kids an allowance, and that's the way I grew up, you're going to teach them to be little entitled socialists. They are going to grow up thinking that I get money by somebody just giving it to me just because I exist, and therefore if I exist, then I must have a right to money. You want to teach them from the youngest of ages, even toddlers. You work for money. They do their little thing. If they put away a dish for you or whatever, you know, some little task, give them a little coin or something. You start teaching them that you, when you do work, you earn money. Another thing is that, this is what I believe anyway, never loan your children money for anything at any age. I don't care how old they are, whether they're little kids or adult kids. Don't loan your children money for anything. Because again, you will teach them something by doing that, especially when they're young. You will teach them to be impatient, discontented debt slaves. They will start to understand, when I want something, I can get it right now if somebody else just gives me the money for it, and then I can pay that person back over time, and then I can have whatever I want right now, and I don't have to wait, I don't have to save, right? So you're teaching them something when you loan them money. I would never loan your children money for anything. Make them save. Make them lay up. Make them understand that to get things, I need to labor and work for them and lay by in store by myself. I need to save so that I can pay for the things I want. Make your children pay, or make them save money and pay for things that they want that are beyond their basic needs. And I think I mentioned this earlier as well. Their basic needs would be food, clothing, shelter, medical care, things like that. But outside of the basic needs, when they want something, they want some toy, they want some whatever it is, whatever thing that they want, you tell them, okay, you can have that, but you're going to have to find the money somewhere. And how are you going to do that? That requires labor. You're going to have to work. You're going to have to underconsume, you're going to have to save that money and buy it. When a child gets his first job, I recommend, when they're, you know, under 18, when they're in the under your roof, I recommend requiring them to save 50% of their earnings, to give 10% to the Lord, and then to spend, if they want, the other 40%. But I think you're within your rights to do that. You're providing them free rent, free clothing, free food, free, you know, you're providing all their needs. So you have a right to say, if you're living in this house, when you work, you're going to save 50% of your income. You're going to give 10% to the Lord, and then the other 40% is for you. Hopefully, that'll stick with them as they move into adulthood. It may not. They may go off and live like fools, but at least you tried anyway. You can, you know, it's up to you, whatever percentages you choose, but that's what I would recommend. This will get the kids off to a good start in life, both in terms of wealth and money management skills. I mean, if they are industrious children and they start working from a really young age, like even younger than teenagers, and then they get to be teenagers and they start working a full-time job in the summertime and part-time during the school year, and they're laying up half of their money, those kids could have a lot of money saved up by the time they're adult, by the time they enter adulthood. But more importantly than that, they learn money management. And that's far more important than whatever money they can actually lay up when they're kids. If parents do not teach their children to manage money well and to be savers, both by their precept and their example, their children will likely end up to be broke their entire lives. Because people produce after their kind. You know, the Bible teaches that. That's more of a biological fact, that people, animals, whatever, produce after their kind. But you know, it's also true socially. It's also true as you train up your children. You will produce children after your kind. They are going to act like you. They're going to make decisions like you. They're going to follow in your footsteps to a large degree. And that goes for the good things you teach them and show them, and also the bad things you teach them and show them. Have you ever seen some little kid utter some horrible word out of his mouth and the parents say, "I have no idea where he heard that"? Well, I know where he heard it. Either in your house or among friends that you should have never let him be around, one of the two, or something, right? It's funny, you're like, "Oh, I wonder where he heard that." You ever see the movie, was it The Christmas Story, with the little kid that was going to shoot his eye out? Remember, you shoot your eye out, kid? Oh, come on, you've certainly, I forget what it was called. They bundled them all up, you know, and he walked around. Come on, I can't believe you guys haven't seen that movie. You got to be kidding me. Anyway, the kid's dad was changing a tire on the car or something, and he heard his dad say something that he really shouldn't have said. Well, then later on, the kid did something upset him, and he dropped the F-bomb, and his mother wanted to know, "Where did you hear that?" And he said, "Oh, it was Tommy, my friend." When he calls up Tommy's mother, and you can hear Tommy's mother yelling at poor Tommy and beating the tar out of him for saying that, he's like, "Truth be told, I heard the old man say it," right? He heard his dad say it, and that's why he said it. Anyway, I can't believe you've even seen that movie. It's crazy. Anyway, where was I with that? So if you don't teach your children to be savers by your example and by your instruction, chances are they're not going to be. They're going to be broke their entire lives like everybody else. And this is not just the opinion of some raving, ranting preacher. Here is Thomas J. Stanley, the millionaire next door. You know, the guy that spent his entire life studying millionaires. Here's what he found. UAWs, that's an acronym for Under Accumulators of Wealth. That's a euphemism for foolish people. The foolish man spendeth it up. Remember, Proverbs teaches us that. UAWs, people don't save any money, they blow everything they make. Average American, in other words. UAWs tend to produce children who eventually become UAWs themselves. That what is expected of children, rephrase it with the right emphasis. What is expected of children who are exposed to a household environment predicated upon very high consumption, few, if any, economic restraints, little planning or budgeting, no discipline, and pandering to every product-related desire. Like their UAW parents, As adults, these children are often addicted to an undisciplined, high consumption lifestyle. Further, these children typically will never earn the incomes necessary to support the lifestyle to which they have grown accustomed. So there's two big problems here. If you live an undisciplined, big spending lifestyle and your children watch that and they see you just spending every penny that you make and everything that you want, you buy, and you have no discipline, you never deny yourself, and you're always broke and you're always wondering, it's paycheck to paycheck, we're always stressed out at the end of every month. If you do that, your children are going to end up living like that more than likely because that's all they know. That's a problem. But secondly, wealthier people that do this, when their children grow up, their children more than likely are not, as he said, are not going to be wealthy like they are. They're not going to have the high income that their parents have. They're going to be accustomed to big time spending, but they're not going to have the money that their parents had. And then they're going to have a real problem. And their parents are either going to have to let them learn the hard lessons, which they probably won't if they're that type of people, or they're going to have dependents for the rest of their lives. They're going to be doing what they call economic outpatient care, giving money to their kids because, you know, their kids can't maintain this lifestyle that they've been accustomed to. On the other hand, parents who are wise with money and are savers will tend to produce children who act likewise. Remember, people produce after their kind. Here's from The Millionaire Next Door again. PAWs. This stands for prodigious accumulators of wealth, i.e. wise, frugal people who save money, accumulate, invest, right? People who become wealthy. PAWs tend to produce children who become PAWs. If you live a life of frugality, of saving, of under-consuming, of being content with the things that you have, right? Not keeping up with the Joneses, your children are probably going to pick up on that. Because you know what? When you grow up, everybody that grows up in a household thinks that their household is normal. Whether your household is normal or not is another story. A lot of us grew up in households that really weren't normal, but we thought they were normal because that's all you know. Well, if your children grow up with somebody who is disciplined and frugal and is a budgeter and a saver, they're going to think that, that is normal behavior, and that's just what you do, right? And they're going to probably act like that, hopefully. On the other hand, like I said, if they see the other type of lifestyle, the regular American lifestyle, they're going to think that's normal too. And the first thing they do when they turn 18, they're going to get a credit card and they're going to start maxing that thing out. They're going to get a car loan. They're going to get this loan and that loan and that. And before you know it, you know, they're going to be on the old treadmill again, just like their parents were, because that's what they thought was normal. The Bible teaches that if you train up a child in the way he should go, especially by your example, he will not depart from it when he's old. Let's look at Proverbs 22 and verse 6. I don't have as much scripture in this sermon as I do in some of the other ones, but I do have a few. Proverbs 22 and verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, it's possible that you could live wise and frugally and budget and save money and be an investor and so on, and your children might depart from it for a while. They may have to go out there and live like the rest of the world does for a while. They may have to do the prodigal son thing for a while and be stupid with money for a while until they realize, you know what? My parents were actually onto something. My parents knew how to do it. My parents aren't stressed out. My parents aren't broke all the time. My parents aren't living like fools, right? I'm going to go back and do like they did. So it says when he's old. When he's old, he will not depart from it. So they may depart for a season, but they'll come back to it is the hope. Now, training up a child in the way he should go includes training him to never borrow money. Look at the next verse. Dave Ramsey pointed this out, and I think he's right. I don't think it's a coincidence that verse 7 follows verse 6. The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. Everybody quotes Proverbs 22:6. I mean, any parent knows that. Any Christian probably knows that verse. I mean, that's a very, very common verse. The next one says that the borrower is servant to the lender. If you're going to train up your children in the way that they should go, One thing you definitely want to train them, among many others, but one thing you do not want to neglect to train them is to never borrow money for anything, with the one exception, and you know what the one exception is, I've already told you. Your first house. Your first house. There's your one exception to borrowing money. Your first house. But only borrow money for your first house. This is probably the second or third time I've said it, and I'm going to say it more times throughout this series because this is so important, I think, anyway. Here's when you know you're ready to buy a house. You have no other debt. No debt, period. You have 3 to 6 months of living expenses saved up in an emergency account. You have a 20% down payment on that house. That way you don't pay PMI insurance. So you're not paying the insurance to be, you know, to be a dangerous lender, essentially, is what that is. You're paying a bunch of extra money because they think you might default because you don't have a 20% down payment. So you've got no debt. You've got 3 to 6 months living expenses saved up. You've got a 20% down payment. And you're going to take out a 15-year fixed rate mortgage, which the payment is no more than 25% of your take-home pay. That is how you know you can afford a house. And that, in my view anyway, now you can do it differently if you want, at your own peril, I think. But that, in my view, is the way that you can be safe to buy a house. And that is the only debt I believe that anybody should ever take out for any reason is under those strict criteria. And if you do that, you'll be fine. And you'll be able to pay it off in 15 or less years. You're not going to be a debt slave your entire life. And like I said, your first house. What a lot of people do is they buy their starter house. They get a 30-year loan on it. They pay a boatload of interest for the first 5 years or so. Then they have to buy a bigger house. So they basically take out another 30-year loan, right? And then the rat race continues, and they do that their entire lives. And guess what? They're 70 years old, and they're not even having their loan, their mortgage paid off, which they should have paid off decades ago. So teach your children that. Drill it into their heads. Never borrow money. Never take out a car loan. Never put money on a credit card that you don't pay off the next day. Never go to a furniture store and take the 90 days same as cash. Never, ever, ever buy anything without paying for it, except for your first house, with those stipulations. Like I said, if you didn't get it that time, you're going to hear it again, because this is so important, I believe. All right, when to save. When to save. So we've looked at how it's important to save early in life. 3 years old, I'm not going to fight with you. If you want to wait till 4 years old, that's all right. But, you know, 3 years old to 4 years old, something like that, that's when you really need to start being a saver. But it's not going to end there. I mean, unless you're a really good saver. I mean, unless you end up, you know, in adolescence and you've got enough laid up for the rest of your life, it's not time to stop yet. You want to save throughout your entire life. Saving money should begin in early childhood and last until death, or until you don't have any income to save. You know, if you get to a point where you have enough saved to live off of for the rest of your life, and then you want to stop working at that point, then you don't have any income, you know, then you're not necessarily saving income, but, you know, you're still going to be bringing in dividends. You're still going to have investment income. I guess you could save some of that and reinvest it. And you could, this is not the time to go, you know, dumb and dumber and buy a Lamborghini or something and blow all your money so you don't have enough left. So you're still saving in the sense of you're not overspending, but you're not saving income necessarily if you don't have any income anymore. But that's what I think. I think it's just a good practice. And if you get into the practice of that, even if you've got plenty of money laid up, you're still going to be a saver. You're still going to save some of your income no matter how much money you have laid up, because it's just going to be a part of who you are. Now, the amount of money that one saves may vary during different periods of life, right? There are going to be times in life where you're not able to save as much as other times in life. Now, sadly, one time in life when you really should be able to save a lot is when you're young and single and, you know, hopefully if you're making decent money and you have very few expenses, that's the real time to get busy. But that's the time when hardly anybody saves, right? The most important time to save is when most people don't do it. Most people save little when they're young, And then when they get older and then they start to see the handwriting on the wall, so to speak, then they decide to get serious about saving. And that's what most people do. They blow through all the years when they should have been doing it, when they had time and interest on their side, and then they look, they're like, oh man, I'm old, I don't have anything saved, and then they try to get busy. And that's good to do it then, but you don't have time and interest on your side anymore, and you're not going to get nearly as far. But this is the opposite of what should happen. Saving early in life, like I said, puts time and interest to work for you instead of against you. You realize that the law of 72, I don't know if you've ever heard of the law of 72, but you can divide the number of years by 72. I forget, I have to think about exactly how to frame that. But basically, for instance, at 7.2% interest, your money doubles every 10 years. So if you start saving and investing, and you can invest at 10% interest, for instance, so 7.2, it doubles in 10 years. At 10%, it doubles about in 7 years, 7.2 years. So if you can invest early in life at 10% interest, your money's going to double every 10 years. So you invest a bunch of money in your 20s, and by the time you're 30, you've got a nice chunk of money invested. When you're 40, you've got twice as much. When you're 50, you've got twice as much again. When you're 60, you've got twice as much again. You've got like four times as much money. When you're 70, right, it just compounds and doubles and doubles and doubles. But if you wait until you're older to do that, you lost all that time and compound interest. That's why it's important to start young. I'll talk about that more when I get into investing here in a week or so. Now, when to save. So we looked at saving early in life. We looked at saving throughout your life. But then when do you save as far as like in the here and now, in the immediate, when you get paid, when do you save? How does that work? And I say, save as soon as you get paid. Now, most people don't do this. Most people save whatever is left after they pay all their expenses for the month. That's what most people do. They get their paycheck. They make all their payments on all their debts, right? They pay their car loan, they pay their credit card, they pay their personal loan, they pay their HELOC, their second mortgage, they pay their mortgage, they pay all these loans, they pay to the furniture store, and they pay it to the whatever. You know, they pay all these payments, and then they pay the electric bill, and they pay the gas bill, and they pay the internet bill, and the phone bill, and the Amazon bill, and whatever else. They pay all this stuff. And then at the end of the month, if they happen to have $5 left over, then they save that. Maybe. Right, that's the way that most people do it. But I shouldn't say that. Actually, most people, if they have $5 left over, it's time to go to Starbucks now. Right? Most people, they don't save anything, as we've seen last week. But most people, that's what they do. They pay all the expenses, and if they have any left over, that's what they save. That is not the way to do things. If you do it that way, you will never save hardly anything. It's just human nature. It's foolish because it makes saving one's lowest priority and usually results in saving very little. Because you realize that if you save what's left, you have prioritized your spending. And what is your lowest priority, your last priority? Saving. Right? If you save what's left, it is your absolute last priority. That says something about a person. If your lowest priority is saving money, you're messed up. There's something wrong. The wise way to save is to do it as soon as you get paid. It's to move a set amount of money or a percentage of money, however you want to do it, into a savings account as soon as you get paid and then live off the rest. You want to prioritize savings. So the first thing you do when you get paid is you save. Actually, I'll take that back. Second thing. First thing you do is you pay the Lord, right? You put money into the Lord's money. The second thing you do is save. That should be the second item on your budget. And if you don't have a budget, you should have one. Whether it's like the American Constitution form of a budget where it's written out, which is probably the best way to do it, or whether it's like the British Constitution, which is oral tradition, whatever. Whether you have a written or an unwritten budget, you ought to have a budget for sure. And if you don't have a budget, one way that you can still make out okay is save first. If you do that and you don't budget the rest of your money, you might not do as well, but at least you know you've got that money saved. And then if you don't do well with the rest of the money, You've got the money saved, though. You started off right. But I'll talk about that when I get to budgeting. I got more to say about that. So you save as soon as you get paid, and then you live off the rest. In other words, you create an artificial environment of scarcity. That's how the millionaires do it. They either are really good budgeters, and I'll talk about this later, or they live in an artificial environment of scarcity. They force scarcity upon themselves. They save X amount percent right off the bat, and they live off the rest. And then, so they've made it seem like they only have 75% of their budget to live on or whatever, and then they live off of that, and that 25% or whatever percentage they're saving, that money does not exist, right? It's artificial scarcity. Those are your two ways to do it if you ever want to get ahead. This makes saving a high priority and results in more money being saved and less spent and wasted. Which leads us to the next point now, how to save. So we looked at when to save, early in life, throughout life, and first thing, every time you get paid, the first thing you do is save. Next is how to save. Well, like I just said, you save first before spending. Everybody prioritizes. You realize that, right? Even the dumbest person out there that you can imagine, he still prioritizes when it comes to his spending. I mean, unless you are just off the charts dumb. I mean, I don't know really anybody that as soon as they get paid goes immediately to the bar and drinks away their entire paycheck or goes immediately to the casino and wastes it all. If you do that, you're just beyond help, right? So I'm talking about normal dumb people. I'm not talking about like the dumbest of the dumb, okay? Normal dumb people, everybody has a priority, right? You're probably going to prioritize your rent first, right? Like if you don't prioritize your rent, you're going to be homeless, right? So most people probably would prioritize their rent first and then their food because nobody likes to starve, right? So you probably would prioritize food, rent, food, and then, you know, whatever. After that. And then, of course, saving is last. But like I said, you want to prioritize differently. First priority is giving to God. Second priority is saving. And then probably your next priority is housing and then food and then whatever. You know, so you go down the list. And if something doesn't get taken care of and it's on the bottom of the priority, that, you know, that's okay. Maybe you wanted to put away for some special thing and you just didn't have enough left over to put away for that special thing. Well, fine and dandy. Right, but you've prioritized the saving. Warren Buffett, who many consider to be the greatest investor of all time, he's worth about $150 billion with a B, so he knows a little bit about saving and investing. He said, "Do not save what is left after spending, but spend what is left after saving." There it is. I mean, there is financial well-being in one sentence. Just that simple thing. If you do that, if you save first and then spend, you're going to be fine. And then learn to invest what you've saved. We'll talk about that later. So how do you save? Make it automatic. Make it automatic. There's a book I read years ago. It's called The Automatic Millionaire. I haven't read it for 15 years or more. But it was a really good book. And his point was, make it automatic. And I've pretty much done that my entire life. If you're on a salary and your paycheck is the same every month or fortnight or week, let me see a show of hands. Who knows what a fortnight is? Okay, some of you. I didn't know what it was until that long ago. I think it's a word that the Australians use quite a bit. I think I read an Australian use that term one time. I'm like, what is a fortnight? And so I looked it up. It's 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Fortnight is 2 weeks. So if you get paid a set amount, you know, you're on salary, or even if you're not on salary, if your paycheck's the same every month, fortnight, or week, then this should be very easy. I said this in the section when I was talking about being self-employed versus employed and how easy it is to be an employee. If you're on salary and your paycheck's the same, your life is so simple. I mean, you may have other problems in life, but as far as your budgeting and your financial life, it is so simple. And nowadays, my goodness, you can make it automatic. You literally don't have to do anything. This is what I used to do. When I was on salary, if my paycheck hit the 15th, the 1st and the 15th, whatever it was, I don't remember. But if it hit the 15th, on the 16th, in my bank account, I had automatic transfers set up. And it would automatically transfer money to the Lord's money, money to the housing fund, money to the car fund, money to the bill money fund, money to the vacation fund, or whatever. Automatic. If your bank doesn't do automatic transfers, you need to get another bank. I got a credit union that's awesome. I really like it. And by the way, if your bank charges you fees for anything, get another bank. If you're paying a penny to your bank for any reason, get another bank. I pay nothing to my bank. In fact, my bank pays me, and I'm not talking about interest. My bank actually gives me a profit sharing at the end of the year for the money that they make because it's a credit union and it's owned by the people. I pay nothing for checks. I order a book of checks, free. Nothing. I pay nothing for ATM visits. I haven't been to the ATM in years and years. I don't remember the last time. But anyway, pay nothing for ATM visits. And if I do, they reimburse me for ATM fees at a foreign ATM. Literally, you pay for absolutely nothing. So yeah, if your bank charges you any minimum balances, if you pay anything for minimum balance, get a new bank. There are better ones out there. And yeah, just do the automatic transfer thing. And then I would even have automatic transfers when the rent came due. I would have the rent money transferred from the bill money to the checking account the day before that comes out. And I could just literally just sit there and watch it. I didn't have to do anything. It was really cool. So yeah, make it automatic. Automatic transfers. This is what you call telling your money where to go, not wondering where it went. Most people wonder where it goes. At the end of the month, they're like, what happened to all my money? You shouldn't wonder where it went. You should tell it where to go from the very beginning. You should be in control of your money, not your money in control of you. Now, if your income varies from pay period to pay period, then you may have to do this manually. So it's not as easy for me as it used to be because my income varies from week to week, month to month, whatever. So you got to do it manually. Here's another way. How to save? When you get a raise, don't change your spending, but save the increase. This is how you will build wealth. When you get a raise, and typically as you get older and you get more experience, you get raises. And then when you take a new job, you get a job paying more money. And that's usually how most people's lives work, is as the longer you live, the more and more money you make. And here's the little secret. Every time you get a raise, every time you take another job, every time you get more money for anything, don't change your spending. I know I mentioned this before. I've always done this. People say, well, yeah, that sounds great, but nobody can do that in the real world. Oh, yes, you can. I've done it my entire life. I already told you about it. Here's a story that I didn't tell you. When I moved to Minneapolis, I told you that I was had a very, very low income, like way below the poverty line. I probably could have qualified for every government program in the world at that point. Not that I'd take any of them, but anyway, when I first got there, I was actually had to take money out of my own savings to pay bills because, you know, I just didn't have it. Even living as ultra frugally as I was, let me tell you, talk about frugal. I didn't drive my car one time for 3 weeks straight. I think it was at least three, might have been more, but it was at least 3 weeks straight. I didn't drive my car for so long, the shifting mechanism like seized up, and I almost had to go and have the shifting cables replaced because I didn't, I hadn't shifted gears in 3 weeks. It just, like, the car just sat there. I didn't drive my car for so long. Gas prices went way up at one point to over $4 a gallon, and everybody in church was complaining about it. I'm like, really? Gas is $4.25? I had no idea. I hadn't driven in weeks. I rode my bike to Bible study. I rode my bike to the grocery store, packed that thing full of groceries. I mean, I'm telling you, when I say I was living frugally, I was living frugally. And I still had to pay out of savings. Just, for the first bit there anyway. So I went and got a job at Mathnasium tutoring math because that was the right thing to do, obviously. Oh, and one more thing too, and I'm not telling you you have to do this, but I'm just telling you an example. When it says in Proverbs chapter 3, honor the Lord with thy substance and with the first fruits of all that increase, so shall thy barns be filled with plenty and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. Even when I was paying for living expenses out of my savings, I would still tithe my income to the Lord. So essentially, I was taking money out of savings and giving it to the Lord, if you want to think about it that way. But you know what? I didn't do that for very long, and the Lord filled up my barns. I'm telling you, He does what He says He'll do. And I tell you that just to show you an example in real life. But anyway, so I went and got a job at Mathnasium. And you know, I never spent a penny of the money that I made at Mathnasium. Isn't that weird? I'm spending savings, right, before I get the job at Mathnasium. And I get the job at Mathnasium, and I never spend a penny of it. Eventually, I did. I put it in an account for travel. So I pay for my travel going back to Pennsylvania, right? So I used it as a travel fund. But I never actually lived off any of that money. You say, well, how is that possible? Did you get more frugal? No. The Lord filled up my barns with plenty. People started giving me money. And I never asked for anything. I never told anybody I needed money. I never insinuated I needed money. Nothing. I guess people just figured, brand new preacher in a small church, and people started sending me money. People from other churches, other church members, other pastors, people outside the church. One time I got a book in the mail. I got a package. It was a book. It was a commentary on Ecclesiastes by Charles Bridges. Mike Birmingham, Mike and Jamie Birmingham from Detroit sent it to me. Mike died here several years ago. Really great man. Anyway, I get this book. I thought, well, that was really nice. He put a nice note there, you know, encouraging me. I thought, oh, that's really nice. I pick up the book and I start paging through it. I'm like, huh, there's a $100 bill in there. I keep paging. There's another $100. There's another $100. There's another $100. $400 in that book. That's just one example. I never asked for anything. The Lord filled up the barns. I didn't actually need that job. I thought I needed it. It was the right thing to do to get the job. But it turns out I didn't actually need it. But like I said, instead of just increasing my standard of living and starting going out and having fun or whatever, I just saved it all, you know, and then used it to travel, go home, see my family. When you get a bonus or unexpected money, save most of it, only spend a little of it. You know, what do most people do when they get a bonus? It's gone, right? They just go blow it. Well, don't blow it, save most of it. That's money that you didn't expect, so it should be easy to save it, right? You shouldn't have it already spent before you get it, unless I guess you know what's coming, but anyway, save it. Foolish people do the opposite, and they spend any extra money they get. Again, this is not just the opinion of a raving preacher. Here's Stanley in The Millionaire Next Door. He says, many Americans, especially those in the under-accumulator of wealth, UAW category, know how to deal with increases in their realized income. They spend them! Exclamation point. Their need for immediate gratification is great. See, it's not just me saying this. This is what they say, too. This is what they found. How do you save? Probably one of the most important things you can remember. Live well below your means. That's how you save. That's how you get ahead. That's how you build wealth. And as a matter of fact, that is the only way to build wealth, is live well below your means. You will not build wealth any other way than living well below your means, period. Unless you happen to win the lottery or get an inheritance. But other than that, you will not build wealth any other way than living well below your means. This is what all self-made wealthy people do. Again, let me give you some quotes here from The Millionaire Next Door. This is from the preface, which was written in 2010. So the book was written in 96, I believe. This is written quite a few years later. So this is more up-to-date information, although it's still dated because a lot's happened in the last 15 years. But here's what they say. Fully 90% of millionaires who live in houses or live in homes valued at under $300,000 are extremely satisfied with life. 90% of millionaires live in homes under $300,000 and they're very happy. Now, granted, $300,000 then and now is different. That's probably more like $400,000 or $500,000 now. But honestly, you know, if you $400,000 or $500,000 house, especially in a metropolitan area, in a suburb of a metropolitan area, is like a house. It's like a normal house. You know, a decent house, a nice house. But it's, I mean, you're not talking about like the mansion on Titus or something out there, you know, Shemwell's house or something. I mean, you're talking just a normal house, right? 90% of millionaires live in just a normal, nice house, and they're perfectly happy with it. That's what they found out. 90% of millionaires. You know what that tells me? They're living way below their means. And as I will say over and over again, that's why they're millionaires. Right. Well, anytime you hear anything about what a millionaire does, just tack on to the end of it, and that's why they're millionaires. There's a reason why they're millionaires. he continues, about one half of the millionaires in America don't live in upscale neighborhoods. So half of them just live in normal neighborhoods just like everybody else. You wouldn't know they're millionaires. That's why the book was titled The Millionaire Next Door. You just think he's just a normal guy, and turns out he's a millionaire. He continues, interestingly, the millionaires I interviewed in Oklahoma and Texas, for example, had the same set of traditional American values as those whom I interviewed in New York City and Chicago. Now, I find that mind-boggling because I didn't know anybody in New York City and Chicago had traditional American values. That is really fascinating. The large majority was keenly interested in being financially independent. That's why they lived below their means. So he's seeing similarities here. It doesn't really matter if you're some honky that lives in Oklahoma or Texas, or you're some guy that's rubbing shoulders with the highfalutin people up there in near Wall Street, right? There's something common to them all. They all live below their means. Isn't that interesting? He continues, but the millionaire next door types do it differently. As one millionaire woman trained as an engineer told me, quote, after college, my husband, also an engineer, and I both got good jobs. We lived on one income and saved the other. See, I'm not the only lunatic out there. There are other people that live like this. I don't recommend the two income things. I'm not a proponent of that. I don't think that's a good idea at all. But I mean, if you're going to do it that way. Live off one income and save the other. At least make hay while the sun shines if that's what you're going to do. Oh, where was I here? We lived on one income and saved the other. Anytime we got raises, we just saved more. That's exactly what I was saying just a minute ago. Anytime you get a raise, save more. For instance, if you're making $2,000 every pay period, we'll just say. You make $2,000 every 2 weeks. Say you get a raise and you're making $2,300 every 2 weeks. What do most people do with that extra $300? They blow it. They get another car. They get another, they go out to eat more. They have more fun. They go out on more vacations or whatever. They do something. They blow it, right? But the millionaire mindset is, I'm going to take that extra $300. I'm going to give 30 of it to the Lord, right? That's 10%. And then the other 270, I'm going to save. So I'm still going to live on 2,000 every pay, just like I was before, except I'm giving that extra to the Lord. And then the remainder of it, that 270, I'm saving every 2 weeks instead of spending. And then if you invest that 270 and you keep doing that as you get raises, investing that, you're going to become very wealthy over the course of time, God being your helper. But anyway, she says, anytime we got raises, we just saved more. We have lived in the same modest 1,900 square foot home for 20 years. Sometimes my kids ask if we are poor because I make them order from the $1 value menu. Like I said, you can tell us it's 15 years ago. There is no such thing as a $1 value menu anymore. Maybe they sell individual French fries for that price or something, but the dollar menu I think is gone. I haven't been to McDonald's in like a fortnight of years. But anyway, as far as I know, the dollar value menu is gone, I'm pretty sure. But yeah, this is the typical millionaire. You get raises, you just save more. You got that same house that you started out in that was, fine for you when you were younger, and you just keep living there. You pay the thing off. Then you just invest the money that you used to be paying on it, and you live frugally. I mean, there it is right there, a real-world example. They continue in the book, affluent people typically follow a lifestyle conducive to accumulating money. In the course of our investigations, we discovered 7 common denominators among those who successfully build wealth. Number 1, they live well below their means. Right? This is the key, like I said, to building wealth. Number 2, they allocate their time, energy, and money efficiently in ways conducive to wealth building. Number 3, they believe that financial independence is more important than displaying high social status. See, the people that display high social status don't have any money. The people wearing the nice branded flashy clothing, the people carrying around the Gucci or the whatever the other, I can't remember all. I don't carry around designer bags, you can tell. But anyway, the people that do that, the people that, you know, like to show off and flash their wealth, they don't have any. Number four, their parents did not provide economic outpatient care. That's when you give money to your adult children and ruin their lives. Number five, their adult children are economically self-sufficient. Number six, they are proficient in targeting market opportunities. And number seven, they chose the right occupation. So now I've covered when to save and how to save. Now let's look at how much to save. How much of one's income should he save? And it depends on one's income, one's family size, and many other factors. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all necessarily, but I think there is a good rule of thumb. And I think the good rule of thumb is 15% of your gross income. 15% of your gross income. Now, if you're in debt outside of your house, then you don't save anything. And we'll get to the debt snowball. You pay off that debt. You keep $1,000 in your mini emergency fund, and then every single penny you can get out of your budget, you put that on your debt, you pay off your debt. So you don't save anything when you're in debt outside of your, or in addition to your mortgage, that is. Once you get out of debt, then you start laying up that 15% or as much as you possibly can, more than that hopefully, to getting your 3 to 6 months emergency fund built up. Once you have the emergency fund built up, and then have just your mortgage, then that's when you start saving 15% of your gross income. And at that point, then you can put that into retirement savings, into an IRA or a 401k or something like that that's tax advantaged. We'll talk about that when we get to investing. And so investing a minimum of 15% of your gross income. That's after you have the emergency fund already built up. Of course, this 15% saving does not include saving for car. Right, that should be a totally different savings account, right? Because you know, you make the car payment to yourself and then you pay cash for it, as I've taught a bajillion times. That doesn't include your car savings account, doesn't include your vacation savings account, doesn't include your home maintenance savings account. I'm talking saving like for the future here, 15% of your gross income. The other saving that you have to do for your normal stuff, that's another story. Now, a single man with a good job could and should save much more than this. You know, there's no reason if you get out of college with a degree that it can actually get you a good job, which is, you know, very few these days, but say you actually do that and in your early 20s you're making good money, you ought to be putting a heck of a lot more than 15% away. I mean, that's nothing, right? That's the time to get busy and you can make a huge difference in the outcome of your life. But if you're a married man, for instance, on an average salary and you've got 6 young children at home and a stay-at-home wife, you might not be able to save that much. You might not be able to save anything or next to anything for a while. But I have a sneaking suspicion that the Lord will take care of such a man. You have 6 children at home with a stay-at-home wife, and even if you can't save anything, I just have a sneaking suspicion that the Lord is going to bless that man. And somehow, some way, he's going to end up being all right. Somehow, some way, the Lord will provide. The Lord says, blessed is the man who hath his quiver full of them. Lord says the wife's supposed to be a keeper at home. You keep the Lord's word and you'd be surprised what the Lord might do to take care of you. But there may be a time, you know, maybe a season where you just can't save much or maybe even anything at all. But that should be temporary, right? And as soon as situation changes, it's time to get saving. Now here's an important question. How much should you have saved by the end of your working years? You know, by the time you retire, so-called. I don't like that word. I hate that word, retire. Because what it means in many cases is that somebody quits working, like when they're still able to work, and then, you know, just goofs around or whatever. You know, it's one thing if you have enough money laid up to take care of yourself for the rest of your life and you want to do that. It's another story, you know, otherwise. And what really irks me is when I hear younger people, like in their 50s, talking about retiring. The only people you ever hear about that either are like self-made millionaires, and that's fine, but I mean, rarely do you meet those types. The only people you ever hear about that are government workers. You ever notice that? It's government workers. It's federal workers. It's state workers. It's local workers. It's school teachers. It's, you know, anybody like that. Librarians, you know, in their 50s are telling, I'm going to retire in a couple of years. It just drives me crazy. You're going to retire on the living off the taxpayers for decades, possibly, where you're perfectly able to work. That just drives me crazy. I can't stand that. But anyway. But how much money, getting back off my soapbox, how much money should you have laid up at the end of your working years when you cannot work anymore and you have to live off your savings? Well, every Christian should strive to save enough money to take care of both his and his wife's needs for their entire lives. That's the principle. That doesn't tell you how much. That doesn't give you a dollar figure, but there's the principle. There's how much you need saved to take care of both you and your wife for your entire life. That's how much you need saved. I'll get to the actual figure here in a second. Parents, as I mentioned last Sunday, parents should not expect their children to take care of them financially in old age if they were foolish with their money during their lives. Parents ought to lay up for the children, not children for the parents. Let's look at the verse we looked at last week, 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 14. This should not be your retirement plan, to live off your children. Like I said, there are cultures out there I am very familiar with that do this very thing. You have children so that they can take care of you. And I'm not talking about in your 80s or even 70s. I'm talking about like as soon as your children hit their 20s and you're in your 50s, then it's time to kick back and enjoy yourself where your kids take care of you. It's ridiculous. Ridiculous. 2 Corinthians 12:14. Behold, a third time I am ready to come to you and will not be burdensome to you, for I seek not yours but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but parents for the children. It's one thing when you've done your best, you live frugally, you save throughout your life, and you outlive your savings despite your best efforts. Yes, then it's your children's responsibility to take care of you, or even your grandchildren's, or your nephews, or your nieces, extended family members. Then it's their responsibility, and I got Bible for you. Let's first of all look at Mark 7. 10 through 11. Mark 7, 10 through 11. Jesus taught us that we are supposed to take care of our parents in their old age if they can't take care of themselves. Mark 7, 10 through 14. He was chastising the Pharisees here because they had made this tradition which made a loophole that they could get out of taking care of their parents. It was called Korban. Mark 7, in verse 10. For Moses said, honor thy father and thy mother, and whoso curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, if a man shall say to his father or mother, it is korban, that is to say, a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free. And ye suffer him no more to do aught for his father or his mother. I've explained this korban principle many times, but they would essentially put their money, I guess, into like a trust, sort of, that was owned by the temple, and it was all legally the possession of the temple, but they had control over it while they lived. That's kind of how a trust works. It was a gift. And if their parents were falling on hard times and they needed help, and then this nice self-righteous Pharisee could say, I would love to help you, but I've given it all to the Lord. I've given it all to the temple. You know, mind you, I still have full control over it, and I'm enjoying it myself right now, but, you know, I can't be mismanaging the Lord's money by giving it to you. It's a gift. And he wasn't, then he was under no obligation, he thought, to take care of his parents. Jesus is obviously condemning him here for not taking care of their parents when they were in need. So a child should take care of his parents when they're in need. And like I said, this could even extend to nephews and nieces, or grandchildren, and the verse I'm going to give you in 1 Timothy 5:4 doesn't specifically say grandchildren, but I would say if nephews and nieces would fit, I would say grandchildren would too. And that's the benefit too of in years past when you had a bunch of kids, you didn't have the demographic problem we have now. If you had 5 or 6 or 7 kids and you get into your 80s and you've fallen on hard times and you've outlived your money, each of your 5 or 6 or 7 kids can contribute a little bit and take care of you no problem. When you got 1 kid or 2 kids or no kids, you know, it's going to be a big burden on somebody to take care of you when you don't have very many kids. But if you had 5 or 6 or 7 kids and then 25 grandkids, every one of them could contribute a little bit and easily take care of you. That's the way it was supposed to work before we had all these social safety nets and socialism and all that kind of stuff. 1 Timothy 5:4. 1 Timothy 5:4. But if any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite, that is to repay, their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. So, in this case, the church was the last resort. If a widow didn't have children or nephews and nobody to take care of her, then the church would take care of the widow. But if there was children or nephews, and I would think by extension grandchildren, then, you know, they ought to take care of her. But this is if she's desolate, right? It says the next verse tells us the qualifications. Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate, right? So you're talking about a woman that just doesn't have anything. And you're also talking about a time when most people were poor. You realize that through most of human history up until the last 100 or so years, like the vast majority of every human being was poor, right? They didn't have a ton of wealth because they didn't have the Industrial Revolution to make, you know, somebody to be able to produce a lot, you know, with machines. So most people were poor. Today, in America, there's no excuse. There's no excuse for being poor. I mean, not very many excuses anyway. I mean, I suppose if you have really bad health or you're disabled or like truly disabled or something like that. But, you know, there are jobs out there. And if you work hard, you can work your way up. You can make a decent living. And just you can invest in the stock market and make returns year after year over time. I mean, there's no excuse for being poor in America. Now, even though most people don't live to 90 years old, some people do. I mean, it's not unheard of. I mean, we all know people that have lived into their 90s. I've had a couple of grandmothers that did, great-grandmother that did, and lots of other family members. I mean, it's not uncommon, especially in my family. Unlucky me. I've got this gene pool here that means I have a pretty good likelihood of living into my 90s, which is not a blessing if you ask me. But anyway, most people don't live into their 90s, but a Christian better plan on it when preparing for retirement in the event that he does live that long. A Christian man must plan to have enough money to provide for his wife for the remainder of her life after he dies, which could be years or even decades. I've given you the example of my grandmother several times. It just ticked over 30 years. Just this past week, my grandfather died 30 years ago this past week. My grandma was a widow for 30 years and still is. It can happen. A man who does not make provision for his wife for the rest of her life after his death, when he could have, is worse than an infidel. 1 Timothy 5:8, this is in that same passage we were looking at. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So this is serious business, laying up to take care of you and your wife. So how much is enough? This is what everybody wants to know, right? At least I think you do. I would. I want to know. How much is enough? Well, before we get to that, first of all, as I've mentioned before, do not rely on Social Security. If you're middle-aged like I am, do not rely on Social Security because it's not going to be there, most likely. The own government's estimates, and I just looked this up just the other day, again, their own estimates say that the Social Security Trust Fund will run out of money in 2033, 8 years from now. It runs out of money, and there's automatic cuts at that point. There's a demographic problem. There used to be a whole bunch of people paying in for every person that was collecting. Now there's a whole lot less. There used to be like 7 to 1. Now it's like 2 or 3 to 1 or something like that. And they've been pillaging the money, and you know, the trust funds are going to be empty, and you know, the government is not going to be able to, I imagine not going to be able to afford to print money to do that. Because if they do, it's just going to, you know, destroy the dollar if it's not already destroyed by that point. It's going to create a ton of inflation. And even if they do mail out the checks aren't going to buy what they used to because of inflation. So given that fact, do not count on Social Security. Do not even think about Social Security. Just in your mind, think that it's not going to be there. And then I recommend that one has at least $500,000 saved with no debt by age 70. $500,000 with no debt by age 70. This would allow a man and his wife to live 20 years on $36,000 per year, which is $3,000 per month, assuming they could make 4% interest. You can do the calculation yourself. There's interest calculators out there. I have one here. It's at calculator.net/retirement-calculator.html. There's a million of them out there anyway. And you can put in your what age you plan to retire, how much money you have, interest rate, how long it'll last you. So if you had a half million, if you had $500,000, it would last you 20 years if you were taking $3,000 per month out and you're making 4% interest. And this $500,000, I am not including home equity in. Because as I said, you have to live somewhere. So you say, oh, my house is worth a half million, I'm good. Well, yeah, you could sell it and have a half million. You've got to live somewhere. You've got to rent something. So I'm not counting home equity in that. The above figures do not factor in inflation. So the number would really need to be higher than 500,000. It doesn't. That's just today. If you were to retire today and inflation remained the same for the next 20 years, good luck, which it won't. Or if there was no inflation for the next 20 years, then you could live for 20 years on $500,000. But that number would have to be considerably higher given inflation. If you need more than $3,000 per month to live by the time you retire, and you likely will, then you would need to have more than $500,000 saved. If you want to stop working, or if you're forced by circumstances to stop working before age 70, you'd need to have more saved. Because remember, you're going to retire at 65, you could live 25 years until you're 90, or 30 years. You could live decades. Like I said, you can use a retirement calculator to figure out how much you need to have saved based on how much money per month you need to live and how long you plan to live or you could live. And like I said, saying that I could die when I'm 68, I could die when I'm 72, I could die when I'm 78, I could die when I'm 85, whatever, that's not a retirement plan. It is not a retirement plan that I could die early. Now, yeah, 85 is reasonable. But to say that I could die before age 70 or something, that is not a retirement plan at all. And really, saying you could die before the average age of 76 or 7 or whatever is not a retirement plan, because chances are you're going to live that long, if you're a normal person. This is also not factoring in expensive medical procedures, some of which aren't even covered by insurance, right? You can have all kinds of money and that kind of stuff. This is not factoring in nursing homes. You're paying, $6,000 a month to a nursing home. How long is your money going to last, right? $100,000 in savings can be gone in a very short time these days. Plan accordingly. 100 grand is nothing. Nothing these days. Be gone in a few years very easily. Or less. So again, I have a few pages left in the outline. I think next week I'm just going to have one page of outline. And then that way I won't get done earlier than my outline. But if I did that, we would be here for about another 75 weeks. So I probably can't do that. So anyway, next week we will pick it up again, and I'm going to talk about the ant. We're going to look at Proverbs chapter 6, and we're going to see the instruction from the ant, how we ought to lay up for the future. And we can learn a lot from the little ant. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.